Okay, so this is Roger Molina on Creative Disturbance, and I'm delighted today to have two colleagues from the University of North Texas in Denton who are visiting today, and I'm going to let them introduce themselves.
Hi, my name is Amelia Jason. I'm a graduate journalism student at UNT in Denton.
Hi, my name is Bobby Nash. I'm an undergraduate student of television production and biology.
Okay, so we've been talking a while. It turns out one of the areas that you're working on is fracking.
Yes.
And you just did another podcast with some other guests. Tell us a few words about that.
Sure. I'm looking at the different discourses that are happening in the media environment. So what's coming from the science arena, what's coming from the industry, activists who are blogging online, and then journalists who are struggling to get the story. So I'm comparing basically all four of those discourses and seeing where they intersect, who's got the strongest voice, what kind of frames are they using, and so forth.
I assume you're familiar with the work of Bruno Latour in Paris at Sciences Po. You know his group? He's worked a lot on scientific controversies, you might take a look at what that group is doing. It's sort of interesting. Because one of the things that he studied very early on is what's called homophily in the web, which is how websites connect to websites that agree with each other. I mean, and so you end up with actually people who agree with each other, you know, connected, and people who agree with each other connected.
Mm-hmm.
And you can see this process happening on scientific controversies where internet doesn't actually help you connect people.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I read a paper recently by Weber and Mong, but it was about the network infrastructure of the internet and how, you know, they looked at sources, authorities, and hubs, and the way information was moving between mm-hmm. them in different patterns, whether it simply went out from this hub or if it went out and was able to come back
mm-hmm.
in, laid out all these patterns, and what they found was that the way information is moving online reflects the organizational structure in the real world. So that was kind of an interesting study, not dealing with science information, but with patterns of information flow online.
So Bobby, you come at this from a different point of view, because you said documentary filmmaking is sort of one of your interests.
Mm-hmm.
And so tell us a little bit about that. Open question.
I think one of the things that really fascinates me about documentary filmmaking arises when you compare it to fictional narrative filmmaking, in that with a good documentary, while a lot of them are, or at least the point of it is to explore a greater social issue, you still need to bridge the gap between the viewer and whatever issue you're talking about, be it fracking or GMOs or immigration or what have you. The most effective documentaries are ones which are able to encapsulate the great issue that you're trying to deal with in the personal story of an individual or a community of people. It's odd that you can watch a documentary and you know that it's false, and you're sort of reacting to it in the same way that you would a narrative film, but the fact that it's a real person it just reaches people on another level. Mm-hmm. It can put someone into the place of someone whose life is directly affected by any of the aforementioned issues or mm-hmm. any other issue that you want to throw in.
One of the people I should put mm-hmm. you in touch with is, we have a lecturer here in the management school, Judd Bradbury, who's doing an art and technology PhD at the moment. And the topic of his PhD is the data narrativist. And he actually just did a study looking how different documentary techniques can be used to structure data narratives.
Mm-hmm.
And because most scientists work at the level, or business people at the level, of data visualization. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And actually constructing the narrative and how you bring together different ways of making accessible the scientific things.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, I'll send you the paper on how, the use of documentary techniques.
Yeah, sounds. It's a wild connection. That's really cool, though.
So both of you, for some reason, are interested in science under the hood, is the phrase I used before. So, and you said you worked in the University of North Texas research division or something, or the.
Yeah.
And that kind of gave you a little bit of the taste of what was going on under the hood.
Mm-hmm.
Well, why don't you tell us about that a little bit?
So I was, at the UNT research office, I would go into labs whenever something was going on, when they made the news or they got a patent or had some kind of announcement to make. So I went in and found out how the chemist thought about her chemicals and so on. And I'm just really fascinated, I guess, with how what's going on in the ivory tower of scientific laboratories makes it all the way through the media system down to the everyman's dinner table conversation. And also, does what people are talking about out in the world make it back up to the laboratory? Does that conversation work both ways? So that's what I'm really interested in doing.
Mm-hmm. Bobby, can you pick up on that in some way? So you said you were minoring in biology.
Mm-hmm.
Because somehow, explain it.
Explain.
Why you're minoring in biology.
My gosh. Like I said before, I ask myself that question a lot. And I'm being completely honest, I don't have a proof for why I think that biology is going to, like, having a biological minor is going to, like, up my ability to do whatever it is that I'm trying to do. All that I have is what it's garnered me in the past, that mm-hmm. being that level of communication that most of my peers in the RTVF field don't have. Along with that, as I'm searching for jobs, it helps me stand out a little bit more. Uh-huh. Like, I had a job over the summer producing media for a pediatric mental health facility. And I was only able to get that because I had this interdisciplinary research.
Mm-hmm.
It made me more marketable. And when I actually got out there, I was able to take up a lot more responsibility than what they'd initially wanted me to do. I was able to connect with the kids that we were working with from a photography standpoint, as well as like an ecological standpoint. I was able to sort of merge those two together.
Gotcha. Okay, so there are two ideas that I have right now where we might take this in the remaining time. So one is, as I mentioned in our earlier discussion, I'm really interested in how you make scientific data intimate, in the sense that you know viscerally what things mean. And so much scientific knowledge is this very distant kind of thing. And so this whole business of bringing scientific knowledge into sort of the personal sphere. So, you know, that's something we might chat about a little bit. But the other thing, and I, you know, this is clearly orthogonal, is one of the things that Bobby bent our ears on earlier this afternoon was this idea of the range of realities between physical, direct sensory reality and virtual reality, which you're in between. So which one of those should we explore?
Yeah. Maybe we could touch the first one briefly.
Okay, go ahead. React to the intimate science one. So.
Sure. Yeah, well, I guess I was thinking in my field, the way that happens often is through metaphor.
Yeah.
Simplifying information, where people can connect to it. Maybe not make it simpler, but make it to where it's something that they encounter every day and can kind of connect to. So metaphors and frames that journalists use to talk about science kind of set off, you know, cognitive schemas for people.
Yeah.
And make the information easier to remember, which in a way is kind of a way of creating reality for people.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's a very...
Framing, ways of framing things so that they connect with things you already know. No sense. One of the comments I make sometimes is, as you probably know, the CO2 in this room. And there's more CO2 in this room than there was 20 years ago.
Why?
Well, because the CO2 level in the atmosphere is going up. And in fact, as we breathe, we're converting oxygen to CO2. I don't know how good the circulation is. But we don't have direct senses for CO2. And CO2 doesn't taste. It doesn't smell. It doesn't sting. And so, you know, carbon dioxide is this kind of like abstract evil or something that we have no direct contact with. And I think many of the things that we're dealing with in science are kind of like that, which is we don't have any direct sensory knowledge of them. So I think that's one thing that artists do, is they make these things intimate in some way. You want to comment on the intimate science thing, or?
I'm taking a slightly different direction. Maybe giving an idea of how, like you were saying, that like how the dinner table conversation makes it back to the scientists, and I hadn't ever thought of that before. It made me think of the phenomenon of science fiction, and like science fiction in the media, and how if you think about how, like, what happens when a science fiction movie succeeds, it's lots of people watching it, lots of people relating to it, lots of people giving it good ratings, going back to the theaters and buying it on DVD. And that a lot of, at least like in the case of virtual reality, that the concept of virtual reality that we have today, of like sitting in a headset and going into a different world, is kind of born of science fiction. And that was something that, you know, when it came about in like newspapers and in the form of film, people were obviously interested in it, and they bought into it. And you know, whoever was in charge of making movies saw, like, at a certain point it took off. They saw, like, okay, this idea of virtual reality is marketable, so that we can, you know, keep making movies like that. And all of a sudden, because there is this interest surrounding a concept, it becomes part of culture. Mm-hmm. Like, it, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Well, and I think there's also like kind of a cultural phenomena where the things that we can't yet do, or the technology that's almost there, what we tend to do to fill in that gap in our knowledge is we use narrative. We invent. We finish the movie with something that seems really fantastic.
Right, like how could it make our lives better? How could it change our lives? Let's play with it in the form of film.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I think, I don't think that scientists are immune to those narratives. Mm-hmm. So they're watching that film going, hey, that's kind of a cool direction to take that, and maybe not consciously trying to copy fiction.
But perhaps inspired by it on some level.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. One of the students in my seminar this semester, Tina Quinn, is trying to figure out how to apply metaphor theory to data visualization techniques. Because it's true that scientists often have these very literal ideas that, you know, the data, you just make images from it, right? Whereas, in fact, there are all these embedded assumptions of what's translatable, what is not translatable. And so, in fact, metaphor theory maybe does provide some tools for thinking about not just the communication thing, but actually the way that we represent the things that we're talking about. And clearly, it's very different to represent things in a VR headset than in a documentary film. And you're in a different sort of system of how you make sense of a narrative. And,
So why is personalizing data so important to you?
All my life as an astronomer, I collected data, so I would go to the lab and I would work with the data. And I got so familiar with the data that it was as real to me as how hot it was or humid it was today, right? Mm-hmm. And then I would go home and talk to friends, and they did not share that experience. And so for them, it was a very abstract experience. For me, it was a real phenomenological experience. I lived it. And so I think one of the problems in discussing science in general is that we don't have the shared experiences and I think that's what interests me about a work of a lot of artists, which is this appropriation of these things, recontextualizing them, redirecting them as cultural objects or cultural processes. And it's almost like a digestion process, right? I mean, it's not very pretty, but then somehow you grow as a result. And so, you know, I think that's a, you know, you can see I'm in a bodily metaphor there, digestion. Mm-hmm. And
yeah. Well, it's interesting that one thing that can be valuable about virtual reality is that you can experience things you would never experience otherwise. So you could share that, the data that you gathered that day with
someone else. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And which, of course, the citizen science and open science movements are doing a lot of now. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, go ahead. We're going to have to wrap this up.
So yeah, yeah.
You get one brilliant final comment.
Crap. I don't know if it's that brilliant. Max and I were talking the other day about the power that virtual reality has to potentially change the way that, for example, people understand like the Krebs cycle within a cell. And we were thinking, you know, like, okay, yes, like you read in a, like, normally nowadays, like you'll either get like a PowerPoint slide or read in a textbook the different stages of the Krebs cycle and what the inputs and the outputs are. We were thinking, you know, what if like tying your shoes was delivered in that way? Like the only, like tying your shoes, like the shoelaces existed like inside of a cell, and the only like idea that you had of how that process went was step by step by step in a book. It would be very, very hard to visualize.
To tie a shoelace.
But if you could like go into virtual reality space and be inside of some visual representation of the Krebs cycle, it might be much simpler and you might be able to internalize it a lot easier if you were actually able to like pull carbon and glucose and like actually like arrange things and see how the system changes based on what you put into it.
Mm-hmm. The virtual reality is still a little ways from that.
Mm-hmm. So you have a closing thought, Amelia?
So much control.
Mm-hmm. I mean, the touch though, like they're getting there.
Our topic, personalizing. Well,
okay, I think we're going to have to wrap this up. So I don't know if you saw the movie Dinner with Andre. Is that what it was called?
My Dinner with Andre.
So I think that's our conversation was like that. So I hope the Creative Disturbance listeners were interested by some of our topics. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.